their food system. They recognize that this is balanced against the out-of-state chemical companies and their profits, and they've done the right thing. They voted to protect their food systems, and we're confident that Benton County voters will do the same thing tomorrow.
All right. Brett Diamond with Benton Food Freedom, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Sam.
All right. And again, my name is Sam Bowman, and we're going back over to Kate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Shake the Dust, May 23rd and 24th at the Clinton Street Theater. Executive producer and rapper Nasir Jones takes a fascinating look at how hip-hop and the acrobatic breakdancing culture strike a resonant chord in the slums, favelas, and ghettos of the world, inspiring young people everywhere to enact social change. In Shake the Dust, B-boys and B-girls hone their gravity-defying breakdancing techniques in virtually every country on the planet, filmed in Colombia, Cambodia, Uganda, Yemen, and beyond. Again, that's Shake the Dust, May 23rd and 24th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in to Prison Pipeline on Monday, May 18th at 6:30 p.m. to hear host Amy Johnson interview Reverend Dr. Emily Bro, the chaplain at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, Oregon's only women's prison. As chaplain, she has an intimate understanding of the lives of the women incarcerated there and of our broken criminal justice system. She's an advocate for sentencing reform, restorative justice, and creating a culture of support in our society so that people are no longer forced into prisons. We'll be asking your questions to Emily, so please email them to us at kboppc@gmail.com. And then tune in on Monday, May 18th at 6:30 p.m.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, P.C., Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Today marks the 35th anniversary of the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens, which blew the top 1,300 feet off the mountain and triggered the largest recorded landslide in the Earth's history. The eruption disrupted the lives of thousands of people and wildlife and transformed hundreds of square miles of rich forest into a gray, lifeless landscape. But in the ensuing 35 years, life has returned to the slopes of Mount St. Helens, which has become a living laboratory for geologists and biologists alike. This morning, Portland State University geology professor Scott Burns joins us to remember that momentous eruption and its aftermath. Scott, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Barbara, it's always fun to be with you, and thank you very much for covering this. This is a big day.
It sure is. I was so happy when I realized that my show actually arrived on the actual anniversary, and that it's one of those rounded, numbered anniversaries that we like to focus on. I was remembering this morning of the last time that Mount St. Helens erupted at all, back in 2005. Actually, it was on International Women's Day, I remember. I remember coming home to my block, which is in Selwood, right up the bluff from Oaks Bottom. And all my neighbors were running down to the bluff. And I asked them, what's going on? And one of them said, Mount St. Helens is erupting. And it was interesting because most of the people that I watched that eruption with that afternoon had all moved to Oregon from California in the last 10 years. And this is back in 2005. And so there were a few of us who were reminiscing about the 1980 eruption. And I realized what a really amazing experience that was to live through. And as exciting as the 2005 eruption was, it was not nearly as transformative. So before we go into the whole history of Mount St. Helens' long volcanic history, let's talk a little bit about that day, May 18th, 1980, and why it was so momentous.
Well, first of all, Mount St. Helens is a volcano in the Cascade Range. And so we have all the way from Mount Garibaldi up in British Columbia, all the way down to Lassen in California. And we're at a plate boundary. And so all of these volcanoes are a result of the Juan de Fuca Plate, which is being generated off the coast, 200 miles off chain of volcanoes, creating a plate that is subducted, goes down underneath North America, melts, and comes back to the surface. And so we have got all of the volcanoes are different. And the baby of all of the big volcanoes is Mount St. Helens. Up until just a few years ago, we only thought it was only 46,000 years old, where most of the other ones are 700,000 to a million years old. And now we have found an older deposit and push it back to 350,000, but it's still much younger than any of the others. And so it's been more active in the last 10,000 years than any of the other volcanoes, making up for lost time. And so when it came back to life in March of 1980, geologists around the world said, oh my God, this is great. There was a small ash eruption. And so we started instrumenting the mountain. It was in the middle of the wintertime. And so that mountain was instrumented with tilt meters, with seismographs, other things, so we could learn from it, because we needed to be able to predict when volcanic eruptions occur much better. And here was a living laboratory right in our backyard. And so we had a couple of small ash eruptions in March and then early April, and then it shut down. It didn't do anything. But what was happening is, on the north side, magma was moving into it, and there was a bulge that was growing at about 5 feet a day. We knew that because we had tilt meters there. And you could actually, in the latter days, you could actually see it growing. Still snow all over the mountain because it is still in May. And then on at 8:32 in the morning on May 18th, there was an earthquake. And this is a seismic zone, and there is Mount St. Helens fault there, and it's probably related to that, at 5.1. And so it was enough to shake the mountain, and this unstable slope started coming down and creating the largest landslide that we have has occurred in modern history. And we can talk about that later on. But what it did is it relieved all the pressure inside of the mountain. And so you had a lateral blast of ash that was coming out, and then an upward blast. And then you just had a big surge that occurred the rest of the day. And that was 9 hours of just incredible amount of ash, cinder, lapilli, what we call tephra or pyroclastics coming out of that mountain. And then you had other things happening all over the mountain on different sides. It was devastating. 57 people were killed. It would have been many, many more, but it was on Sunday, and many of the loggers were not working. Weyerhaeuser was shut down, except for just a few guys that were out there. And so it was, we learned so much from that one eruption. And then as a result, the U.S. Geological Survey formed the Cascade Volcano Observatory over in Vancouver to study not only Mount St. Helens and its aftermath, but all of the other volcanoes here. And then their outreach has reached out now to many of the other volcanoes in the world. So in our backyard, we have the world's top geologists studying them. So we learned a lot then. And then since that time, we've learned many more things.
Well, one of the big lessons of Mount St. Helens for this region, I think, was experiencing cataclysmic change. And it was really, it's very dramatic to watch what was this iconic, one of the most beautiful, symmetrically shaped mountains in the world suddenly turn into this kind of jagged, and for a while I thought very ugly, kind of barren view from, because it was a couple of years before I got up there again. So from Portland, it just looked rather jagged and lifeless and weird. But the power that it took to transform this mountain, I think, was something that very few people had actually witnessed in their lives. I have this book here called A Portrait of Mount St. Helens that has essays by Chuck Williams and Stuart Warren. And Stuart wrote an inscription to me. It says, "There's nothing permanent except change." And that's the lesson from Mount St. Helens. So I want to talk a bit about that. And what do we learn when we're in the presence of such incredible geological forces?
And in our backyard. And so we have volcanoes all over. In fact, we have volcanoes in Portland. The good news is that they are all extinct, and the chances of them erupting is basically nil. But Oregon has more active volcanoes than any other state in the United States except Alaska. And we have six of them. And active volcano means that it's erupted in the last 10,000 years. And so we have Mount Hood, we have Jefferson, we have the Sisters, et cetera. And then across the river, we have got Mount St. Helens and we have Adams. And then further on up, Rainier. And so we are always wondering, you know, what's going to happen next with each one of those volcanoes? In the whole Cascade Range, there are four violent volcanoes. Those are volcanoes that are very, very explosive and produce huge amounts of ash. And Mount St. Helens is one of them. Another one is Glacier Peak. That's further up north in Washington. Mount Mazama or Crater Lake down in southern Oregon, and then Mount Lassen. The others are more gentle giants. They will produce a little bit of ash, but nothing on the magnitude of Mount St. Helens. And they'll produce some lava flows. They'll stay on the mountain, but they will also produce lahars. And these are these slurries that are created that come off of the mountain when the snow and ice melts and then mixes with all of the fragments that are on the mountain, and it gets into the streams and comes down. And Mount St. Helens had some major lahars that went off in all different directions. But it was amazing. The mountain lost 1,300 feet in just one day.
Actually, it was probably in just a matter of moments.
Yeah, right? It was, because of the landslide and everything blowing off. And you had hundreds of acres of devastation, that forest, and a lot of old-growth forest gone. And the helicopter pilots that flew into the area to try and rescue people could not understand where they were. And it was amazing. I grew up here. I still remember 1953 going to Spirit Lake and with my grandparents and going across the lake and having lunch at Harmony Falls Lodge and Boy Scouts. I went to the Boy Scout camp and I worked on the waterfront there. Very, very cold water there. So we used to take a little hike with the Boy Scouts up to Bear Lake. Well, I thought it was just a huge lake up the hill and to a small lake. And then once you remove all the trees, my God, it was not a huge distance. You know, when I went back many years later after the eruption, it changed that whole area. It was devastating, and it was a great example to the whole world of catastrophic change and what volcanoes can do.
I'm actually thinking about the different paths that the different parts of the volcano took, and the one that's probably most pictured these days is the windfall or the volcano fall, all the old growth forests along the side when you go up towards Spirit Lake and Windy Ridge. And it's amazing, you get to basically go around this hairpin curve and suddenly what has been old growth forest is suddenly on the ground, and these trees are now 35 years old, but they're still there and they look like little matchsticks, and it just goes on for miles and miles and miles. But I remember equally well the drama of what went down the Toutle River. And I want to talk a little bit about that, because that's what I saw a lot more of in the couple years after the eruption, because it's right off of I-5. And every time I go up to Seattle, I look at the Toutle River and have my mind blown. So describe what came down the Toutle River and why there was so much devastation in that direction.
And so what came down the Toutle River?
And for people to know, this is the west side of the mountain as opposed to
right.
Spirit Lake is on the east side of the mountain.
That's right. And so the Toutle River was a lahar. And so this is one of these big slurries melting of the ice and the snow that was on the mountain, and then mixing with all of the fragments that were actually going up into the atmosphere and coming down, but also parts of the mountain. And that was devastating. And it wiped out all of the houses that were along the way, outhouses, all the bridges had to be rebuilt. And then all of that sediment went down into the Cowlitz River and then into the Columbia. Columbia was a 40-foot deep channel, and within 2 days, it went to 12 feet. And so all of the big ships could not make it in. And so the Army Corps of Engineers had to come in with their huge dredges, and it took months to get that reopened. And so yesterday, I drove through there on a field trip up to Mount Rainier, and as you go through Kelso Longview, all of the Scotch broom is out right now. And where all that bright yellow Scotch broom is out, those are all dredge deposits of Mount St. Helens ash that had been taken out of the river. And so it's along the Tootle, along the Cowlitz, and along the Columbia River. Amazing change that occurred in that system.
Actually, I think that those dredge deposits wouldn't be done today. I've talked to a number of biologists and naturalists who are pretty appalled that what they did to that side of the Tootle watershed. I also remember, though, that there were the trees. There's a lot of trees along this little river, and they had the lahar markings. I mean, they were stripped of branches up to, like, probably 50, 60 feet. And these are big, I guess, Douglas fir trees. So there was the drama of seeing, like, this river that was just full of debris and mud. And then the Army Corps came and they kind of channelized it and cleaned it up and made it look like an Army Corps project. And I didn't notice until years later what was going on the west side of the freeway, which was the big deposits that are sort of these giant berms now.
Huge.
But I'm wondering, I mean, this was all done back in 1980-81, and I'm wondering if there's second thoughts about how you would reclaim that part of the landscape now compared to the way it was done 35 years ago.
You know, the Corps of Engineers has looked at it, because the Corps of Engineers also has a biological component to that. And the way we look at things today have greatly changed. And in fact, how we deal with rivers. I mean, it used to be channelize the suckers, get dikes on both sides, prevent the flooding, prevent the homes and farmlands on both sides from getting affected. Now, their approach is work with the rivers. And if Mother Nature has a meandering river, we keep that meandering river in. And we're putting meanders back into streams. We're putting woody debris back into the streams. And the Corps of Engineers, along with our state geological surveys, et cetera, are working with the rivers in an ecological environmental approach, which is absolutely good, because you aren't working against Mother Nature. And so, yes, the Corps of Engineers would probably do things a little bit different, but they were focusing in on the commerce and those trapped ships and preventing ships coming up and down. And they destroyed a lot of wetlands, too. That's where most of that area comes. Now they have Plan A, Plan B in case of other eruptions. Where are we going to put this material? And we don't want to build it up too high because we have potential landslides.
Or could have a second mountain on the west side of I-5.
I know. And so the geological thinking is now ecological geological thinking. And so we're doing a much better job in all of those things.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Scott Burns, who's a geology professor at Portland State University. And we're reminiscing about the 35th anniversary of the big eruption of Mount St. Helens back in 1980. Now, this was not the first big eruption of Mount St. Helens, actually, even in human memory. And I guess in Native American legends, there's a lot of, in their oral history, there's much mention of eruptions. But when the European settlers and traders and other people came through, there's also some recording of eruptions starting, I guess, what, early 19th century?
Yes, right.
So what were these eruptions like, and how do they compare with the one in 1980?
The different eruptions, you know, some of them were ash eruptions, like the one, and then some were dome building. And so in 2004, we started the dome building eruption up until about 2008, 2009. And so that did not really produce any ash. Sometimes you had a little bit of steam that went up, but it was magma that is very, very thick, very silica rich, so quartz rich, water rich, and it just kind of oozes out. There were some days that it was growing at 5 feet a day, 5 to 10 feet a day that this dome was growing up inside. And so that was not a violent eruption, but it's the secondary effect after a violent eruption. If you go onto the south side of Mount St. Helens, there is a basalt flow. And that's a different type of rock. Most of Mount St. Helens is what we call dacite, which is a silica-rich volcanic type of rock. But basalt is what we have a lot of around here, and it oozes out of the ground. And it's not a violent type of eruption. The flow went down out of a vent on the south side and created a flow that also had a lava cave in it. We called Ape Caves, and so a lot of people from Portland go visit that.
Now, is that new as of 1980, or did that predate 1980s eruption?
Oh, no.
It's an old one, right?
Yeah, it is. It's 2,000 years old. And so you had different types of eruptions, some lava flows, some dome building, some ash. It's so exciting when you are in the Mount St. Helens area when you dig a soil pit down in the forest, because there are all these different layers, orange, yellows, white layers of different ash eruptions. And you have Mount St. Helens S ash, R ash, etc., and they're all named. And so when we find these things, we take samples, we send them off to Washington State in the laboratory over there, Nick Foyle's lab, and he'll identify it and send it back and say, oh, this is the age, this is the name. And it helps us date whatever the landform is.
One of my favorite hikes on Mount St. Helens is the Ape Canyon hike. Now, when you get there and you kind of can see the Plains of Abraham off in the distance, what eruption are we looking at? What is that landscape the result of?
Most of those eruptions have occurred in the last 10,000 years. I mean, everything that you see up there today is very, very young geologically speaking. And periodically what will happen, there'll be a massive eruption like May 18th, 1980, and you lose half of the mountain or two-thirds of the mountain. And then you go back through dome building episodes. And so this volcano is just going through different stages and different types of magma that happen to be in there. And so... And another interesting thing, there used to be glaciers all over it. I had a grad student who did his master's thesis a couple of years on the south side. And there are still 9 remnants of glaciers up there. I thought they were all gone, but they're still on the outside. And then you have the incredible glacier inside the crater. And that's one of the amazing things to us. When it came back to life in 2004, we thought, oh my God, we're going to have massive debris flows and lahars coming down the Toutle River because you have all this water in the crater and it's erupting. It wasn't affected. And the great glacier continued to grow. And then it was a horseshoe shape. Now it's combined together and coming out. It's one of the few glaciers in the world that is actually growing, even though that there was this active eruption going on there. It's amazing to us.
Well, in 2009, I had an opportunity to climb Mount St. Helens, and it's pretty amazing to be standing on the rim of you're on the south rim of the crater, and looking down, you can see the glacier, you see the lava dome, and there was a lot of steam coming up. Is that steam still coming up, or is this...
Yes.
So this is constant with Mount St. Helens, there's always a little bit of steam being released.
There are fumaroles, or these steam vents that are always there, and climbing, you climb from the south side, and you follow that basalt flow that I talked about, and then it ends at the vent, and then that last 1,000 feet is like 2 steps up, 1 step down, 2 steps up, 1 step
lots
down.
Lots of ash.
And pumice and, right. And cinder and lapilli. But then when you come back down, it takes you 5 minutes to glissade down, and it is just so much fun to do that.
If you're lucky and you don't get off trail, which is what happened to us. And then we're about to glissade over waterfalls.
Oh, that's not good.
No, it was not
good. I know where you were.
It took us a little while to get back to the Monitor Ridge Trail. Let's talk about the ash, because that's the other big thing. We had a KBOO news reporter back in 1980, and he was visiting his family in Spokane and got stuck a few miles west of Spokane by the ash that all blew towards Spokane on May 18th. And he would report back every day to KBOO. It was also during the time of the Iranian hostage crisis. And so he would say, the fifth day held hostage by Mount St. Helens, and I forget which little town he was in eastern Washington. But it was very dramatic what happened then, and we had our own barrage of ash a little bit later, eruption in 1980, but nothing like what landed in eastern Washington. So what was the ash like, and what was the cause of all that ash going in that direction?
Well, the wind directions were, and it got very, very high, 40,000 feet up into the upper atmosphere. And the winds carried it over through Yakima up to Spokane. I still remember it because my cousin was graduating in Spokane from Whitworth College, and my uncle collected samples of it from over there. And so the directions of the ash are dictated by the dominant winds that you have got. That's why I think June 7th, the winds were from the north, and Portland got buried, not buried as much as the earlier one.
Just a few inches as opposed to feet.
That's right. But it still affected us here in Portland. In Yakima, it was like night. People had to put their headlights on if they were driving around. And then your air filter in your car would get totally clogged up. And it was just amazing change because really the United States had never gone through a volcanic eruption. And people didn't know what to do, how to deal with this. Now we do. And we know local emergency management people know in the Pacific Northwest how to deal with it. Also up in Alaska, they deal with it all the time. Alaska Airlines actually has a geologist on staff to monitor all the volcanoes so they aren't flying through ash. So that ash was very important. At that time, in 1980, I was living in Boulder, Colorado, and it was at the University of Colorado. And I still remember 2 days later, I went out to my car, and there was a thin film all over the car. I was at 9,500 feet, and that ash cloud came all the way over. Over there. That ash, it's interesting, one of the biggest bumper crops of apples in Washington was that following year. And so there may have been a little bit of fertilization coming from the ash in that area. But we did not know how to deal with ash. Today we do. And the world knows how to deal with it a lot better. It was a great learning experience for us at that time.
Well, I'm remembering quite well the ash in Portland. Actually, I was up in Mount Hood. I was up on Mount Rainier on June 7th for that. And we woke up that morning and the power was out in the little cabin we were staying in. And then we go outside and go, uh-oh, because there were several inches of ash on the car and all over the place. And then we started back to Portland on, you know, what should have been a very easy journey was really difficult. And we wound up stopping at a shopping center in Chehalis. And we were driving a Saab 900. And my friend, who's the driver, put together, jury-rigged this air filter out of a couple of pie pans and duct tape and a Corvette air filter and put it on his car so that we could get back to Portland. And it was a very slow trip. And we get back to Portland and there's inches of ash on the ground there. And it took the city until the fall to get all the ash out of the in the gutters. And I really wondered, like, what, I mean, I'm sure there were respiratory incidents for people. I had a black cat at that time and his belly turned gray and wow. His belly did not go back to black until after the city cleaned up the streets. So I'm wondering what's the difference now in the way they deal with ash and the way they were dealing with ash in 1980.
Well, around the world, people are prepared. And so masks, if you live close to a volcano that's going to be an explosive type of volcano, like Mount St. Helens, all the emergency managers have large numbers of these things. And so we are much more prepared. The people who work for the city, the public work people, they know what to do and how to take care of the ash and to get it off of the streets and then what to do with it. Where do you dump it? And so it doesn't remobilize and by wind and things like that. So it was a great learning experience for us.
Well, let's talk about some of the other learning experiences that have been like watching the mountain regenerate.
Incredible.
Which is something actually... I think that scientists have one take on it, but one of the most interesting takes I saw was when I visited the Museum of Creation Science that's just east of San Diego a number of years ago. They have a Mount St. Helens room, and this goes to show that the world was created in 6 days because Mount St. Helens came back so fast. So, and this kind of connects to another project you worked on with the Brits floods, the Missoula floods, which is another example of kind of almost instantaneous geologic change, which flies in the face of what a lot of scientists believe is very slow incremental geologic change. So how do you reconcile what happens, either what happened in the Missoula floods or what happens volcanoes like Mount St. Helens with scientific theory? And how do you answer the... charismatic Christians who think this proves that everything in the Bible was true.
And I'm very well aware of that room because I follow the work that the creation science people do. First of all, just the general thing about recovery. It is amazing because when you take the highway up to the David Johnston Ridge Observatory, there's a big sign that says that you are at the edge of the blast zone. And I always take my students there. And they have pictures of what it looked like in 1980. Now those trees, and that's all in Weyerhaeuser land, those trees are 35 to 40. 40 feet high that they have replanted, and they replanted just in the next couple of years. It's interesting that they learned, initially they just planted into the ash. All the trees died. They had to plant through, dig through into the native A horizon and O horizons, and then the trees did very, very well. So the recovery is just amazing in the areas that warehouses are replanted. But in the actual monument where they didn't do any planting, there's still some areas where there are no trees that have come back, and there's just no seed that is locally there. Down along the Toodle River, you've got all those alder trees that are just sprouting up everywhere. And so recovery.
Around the Toodle River, were those planted or
was no? No, they were all natural. Now down in the lower part of the Toodle River, the Army Corps of Engineers planted a lot of grass seed. Well, there was lots of grass, and the elk herd developed to over 900 because there was a lot of food that is there, and you can still see the elk that are there, even though they had a decrease in population a couple of years ago. And at dusk, it's wonderful to see all of the deer and elk coming out of all of the forest surrounding the area. But the plants, the animals, and everything have recovered. And so I encourage people, if they haven't been there, to take Highway 503 out of Castle Rock and go up to David Johnson Ridge, and it's just amazing to see what you've got there. Now, back to the creation science people. Their big thing that they stress there is that there was a canyon that was cut by Lahars coming out of the crater in a very, very short period of time. And so you have a canyon that is about 500 to 1,000 feet deep, carved in a very, very short period of time. And they say, well, that's the same thing as the Grand Canyon. But even the Grand Canyon is a mile deep. It's different. I do a lot of landslide stuff, and so I understand this. And I've talked to all these guys who put these creation science things together, and it's not comparing apples to apples, oranges to oranges. All of the fragments that are in Mount St. Helens, all those ashes are very, very sharp, angular pieces. If you look at them underneath the microscope, they're great interlocking, and they have what we call a high angle of repose. They can hold up angles when it's cut down up to 60, 70, 80 degrees because the individual particles are interlocking. If you go to the Grand Canyon, where you've got lots of layers of clays and shales in there, they have an angle of repose of 10 to 12 degrees. And so if you had the great flood occurring with all these different particle sizes coming in and then carving down in it, all of those particles would have been completely wet, and they would not have been able to have held the slope that they have today. It had to have happened a long period of time after that. And so so I disagree with the people that that shows that the Earth was created in a shorter period of time.
But actually, the Columbia River Gorge was created very quickly too, wasn't it? I mean, very different than the Grand Canyon.
No, it's what we call an antecedent stream. And so the Columbia River has been around for 28 million years, emptying into the ocean from Willapa Bay all the way down to, south of Newport. And it's going back and forth and back and forth. The Cascades really didn't start uplifting until about 7 million years ago. And so as the Cascades were uplifting and the Coast Range was uplifting, the river was there and just kept on down cutting through that. And so the gorge is over 7 million years old.
Well, I'm thinking about the gorge as we know it, as opposed to the gorge, opposed to the pre-Brett's Floods gorge. Because didn't the floods, when they came through, geologically speaking, in a really short time, do a lot of changes to the gorge?
Probably not. So the Brett's Floods or the Missoula Floods came through. They probably cut off the bottoms of the slopes more, deepened a little bit and widened it a little bit. But that gorge was basically established at that particular time, because we can find deposits like up at Rowena, where the floods went over the top. And so the size and the shape of the gorge was basically the same there. There were just minor changes in the big picture. The earlier floods were the basalt flows coming through and pushing the river over to the side. But at that point, there were no major mountains, and they just flowed all the way to the coast and solidified along the way.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Portland State Geology Professor Scott Burns, and we're talking about the Mount St. Helens eruption back in 1980 and sort of looking back 35 years at what the lessons learned from that eruption were and how it's changed the course of Northwest natural history. I want to get back to that whole sense of watching a mountain, just the top of it just disappear in a matter of moments, and what that triggers for the human experience, and what kind of awe maybe sets in when you see something change so drastically.
It is basically awe that the landscape can change very, very rapidly. Whether it is a volcanic eruption or a major flood a huge landslide that is coming down, you can change things. The early geologists, we used to say everything, catastrophism was not possible. All the landscape evolved very slowly over time, and it was called uniformitarianism. We use the term today, but we have a slightly different definition. And so when people like J. Harlan Bretz came up with the idea of catastrophic floods creating the Channel Scablands, they said, no, you are breaking one of the foundation points of geology by saying that things can catastrophically change in a short period of time. For me, seeing these volcanic eruptions, just 2 weeks ago, we had a volcanic eruption down in Chile. Oh my God, was it gigantic. And now, with all of the different ways of taking pictures and camcorders, et cetera, all of this can be set all around the world. Tsunamis. In the last 10, 15 years, we have learned more about tsunamis than the previous 200 years before because we were able to take pictures of those. And a tsunami coming in and completely destroying an area. Incredible. Look what happened in Tohoku. I was down at the local TV station saying, okay, this is what is happening. This is why this is dark. And what's happening is people were killed right in front of our eyes.
Well, I have sort of a strange interchange. A number of years ago, I was at a science literacy workshop in San Francisco, and everybody, the geology section of it was all about earthquakes. And at the end of the session, I raised the point of, I feel, as you know, somebody who lives in the Pacific Northwest, a little shortchanged in this discussion because I would have liked to have discussed volcanoes. And this guy said, well, volcanoes are so much easier to predict than earthquakes. And I said, well, Mount St. Helens, they made a few mistakes in their predictions. I mean, they basically thought it wasn't going to happen when it happened. And he said, well, but nobody got killed there. And I said, well, actually, the same number of people got killed in Mount St. Helens as got killed in the Loma Prieta earthquake in the Bay Area in 1989. So that kind of quieted him down. But I wonder, you know, there's so much talk now in Oregon about the big 9.0 earthquake that we're going to experience sometime soon or sometime not so soon. And I do wonder if people don't, I mean, there's so much emphasis on the danger of earthquake and the unpredictability of it that we don't look at the other serious consequences of living so close to volcanoes.
We live in, a geologist who specializes in all the volcanic, all of the geological hazards. We have it all here in the Pacific Northwest. So I get very excited about them because we not only have volcanoes, we have tsunamis, we have earthquakes, we have landslides, we have radon gas, and we have floods. We have all of those. But at the same time, because we live at a plate boundary, that's why we have all of those. And we also have great scenery and we have great mountains. And we also have lots of rainfall here, so we have big trees and beautiful landscape. So if you live with that, you also have to pay the price of the potential hazards. The most important thing for us is to be prepared, and prepared for any hazard that comes along, whether it's a volcano, earthquake, flood, or whatever. We need to have emergency managers ready, so our fire departments, our police departments, our hospitals, all of them now, this is on the radar screen. And they don't say earthquake. They just say natural disaster. And Red Cross, who I work with, and I'm on the board, they for instance, it's generic. Natural disaster. How do you prepare? In your house, your community, and then the big community that you are in. And so each one of us needs to be prepared for a natural disaster. The biggest chance, the biggest problem that we're going to run into is going to be the big one, the big earthquake, the 9.0. But then we also, on the earthquake side of things, I think in our lifetime have a chance of having a 7.8 to 8.2 on the southern margin. Chris Goldfinger, a professor down at Oregon State, has been putting that story together. And I think that that's probably even more likely than the big 9.0 occurring. So we live in that type of environment.
Well, let's get back to the consequences of living amongst earthquakes. And I do want to talk a little bit about how prepared and unprepared we were back in 1980 for the big eruption. Because you talked about how, I mean, the road was closed to Spirit Lake back in, I guess, late March of 1980. And they actually pulled the logging crews off for a while. And then it seems when the mountain quieted down, then people went back up on the mountain. And I know directly of several people who were up there the day of the eruption, and I've heard some hell-raising stories about people who got down. So what made the officials think it was okay to reopen the mountain, and why were the logging crews allowed back up? And why were those, besides Harry Truman, who owned Spirit Lake Lodge, who refused to leave, why did those people die up there?
Well, they were inside the red zone. And so nobody was supposed to be inside the red zone. Harry Truman was the one guy that said, no, I'm going to stay inside that area. But half the people that died were outside the red zone. Geologists, we didn't predict how big it was going to be. We knew it was going to go down in the northerly direction. That's why David Johnston was at the observatory, but he was wiped out. We just did not believe that it was going to be that big. We underestimated that.
So how far was David Johnston from what was considered the epicenter of the volcano?
Well, it's where the visitor center is today, and that's 5 to 6 miles away from the volcano. And in fact, he could have been further into the blast zone and still have been killed. And so we just did not realize it was going to be that big. This is part of the learning process. And understanding volcanoes better and better. The crew from Cascade Volcano Observatory went over to the Philippines in 1991, Pinatubo, the huge eruption that was over there. And they took all of the information that they learned from Mount St. Helens, size of the volcano, similar type of volcano. We just had an American Air Force base right at the base, and they wanted to know what was the last time that we could keep people there. And they nailed it down within 1 hour. Most of the people were off of the base, and the four geologists there said, it's going to erupt. Let's all get off. And they did, and it erupted. And so we have come a long way in volcanic prediction. And people around the rest of the world working together. There's a huge network that we have got that try to figure out, you know, how do we predict this particular one? And so what we do is we look at the seismographs as magma is moving up into a volcano. That's the initial thing. Then we start looking at the steam vents and the temperature of those, and then also the gases coming out and the change in the gases that you have got. And then the rocks get warmer and warmer as the magma comes closer and closer to the surface. All of these put together, and they do a pretty good job. Someday we hopefully will get there with earthquakes, but we aren't quite there in the prediction of the earthquakes. So they still come basically unannounced.
Well, one last thing before we're out of time. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the return of life to Mount St. Helens. I understand it was started by spiders.
It's a combination of a whole bunch of things. Spiders probably had part of it, but then there were a lot. Remember, there was snow on the ground, and a lot of trees were, you know, seedlings and stuff like that were buried by the snow, and then all of a sudden, 2 years later, you had 4 or 5 feet trees in some of the areas there, and that was because of the snow preserved it, and so the biologists have put together an incredible web of many, many different organisms together, bringing it all back to life.
And I understand that there's life now that wasn't there before the eruption.
And that's right. Remember, Legionnaire's disease, which was in Philadelphia and killed a lot of people at International American Legion Convention, the greatest concentration ever found on the face of the earth was in Spirit Lake in the years after that.
I wonder what the connection was.
We don't know.
Anyway, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Scott. And it's always fascinating to talk about Mount St. Helens. And maybe in 5 years, we'll talk about it some more.
Well, Barbara, thank you very much for covering it. And anytime you cover anything geological, I think it's very exciting to do that. Thank you.
Well, thank you. So I've been talking this morning with Portland State University geologist Scott Burns. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll talk with Columbia Riverkeepers Conservation Director Dan Sears about pressures to turn the Pacific Northwest into an export hub for oil, gas, and coal. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the Neville Brothers. Thanks for listening.
And it is a half a minute before 11 a.m. Coming up at 11 is Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. He speaks with Dr. David Kaya about his new book, The Anti-Cancer Diet, Reduce Cancer Risk Through the Foods You Eat. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Paul Rowland speaks with David Gessner about his new book, All the Wild That Remains, Edward Abbey, Wallace Stegner, and the American West. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in last week's membership drive. If you missed it, you can still donate. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today, and you are tuned to KBOO Portland. Now, we have a couple messages before we go to Health Watch.
KBOO members, what's your vision for your community radio station? How do you see the mission of KBOO? The KBOO Foundation has a programming charter and strategic plan, and now it's time for a mission and vision statement to help direct our policy and inspire the community. From now through May 15th, we're inviting member input on our website. Visit kboo.fm/survey2015 to take our survey. You can also read up on our programming charter and other guidelines and find frequently asked questions at the same page, kboo.fm/survey2015.